Welcome to Watchmen on the Wall, a daily outreach of Southwest Radio Ministries and SWRC.com. God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. Today, Dr. Stephen Collins will begin a fascinating new series that will reveal the identity of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. We're a little over a week away from our next in-person event, Friday and Saturday, May 3rd and 4th, in Bel Air, Kansas. Come hear Larry Spargimino, Greg Patton, Micah Van Hus, Larry Stamm, Josh Davis, Clayton Van Hus, and Dr. Rob Lindstedt. A special One World update will be shared, biblical mysteries will be revealed, and the latest update on what is happening in Israel. All this and much more will be covered at the Prophecy in the News live event on May 3rd and 4th. Register today for this free event. Seating is limited, so don't delay. Visit the events page of our website, swrc.com, or you can register by phone, 1-800-652-1144. That's 1-800-652-1144. Prophecy in the News Live, May 3rd and 4th at Sunrise Christian Academy in Bel Air, Kansas. Historians and Bible scholars have a long history of speculation about the identity of the Pharaoh at the time of the Israelite exodus from Egypt. To help us pull back the curtain of this mystery, Affirm Apologetics director Clayton Van Hus recently visited with archaeologist Dr. Stephen Collins, who believes he has uncovered the true identity of the Exodus Pharaoh.
Welcome to Watchmen on the Wall today. I am your host, Clayton Van Hus, and we're going to be talking today about some very interesting things. We are going to be talking with Dr. Stephen Collins, and he is going to be talking about his book, Let My People Go. Dr. Collins, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Clayton. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, great. Well, I'm very excited about this. You know, I get a lot of books to look at here, a lot of archaeology books, a lot of apologetics books. And for our listeners who don't know, I am the director of Affirm, the apologetics branch of Southwest Radio Ministries. But I get a lot of books here, and I like to read them. I like to go through them. But I do a lot of highlighting and skimming. Your book is one that I actually read a couple of years ago, and I loved it. I couldn't put it down. Your book is called Let My People Go. We'll get into the book in a minute, but first let's talk about you, Dr. Collins. What do you do?
Well, pretty much what you just described. All day, every day, I work in the field of archaeology. Of course, for the last 16, actually about the last 20 years, we've been engaged in the Tal el Hamam excavation project at the site that we believe is biblical Sodom, northeast of the Dead Sea. And so that has pretty much eaten up the bulk of my life over that period of time. But along the way, of course, I'm teaching. I do direct the School of Archaeology for Veritas International University and direct the PhD program. So that takes up a lot of my time as well. But of course, our students are very involved in what we do in terms of archaeology. And so that all meshes together really nicely. And we have a lot of our students actually working on the publication pieces for our excavations. That really helps a lot. We've been involved in Tal Hamam as Sodom, but along the way, there were a few other issues that kind of bothered me because, you know, it always bothered me that we don't have any kind of consensus on who the Pharaoh of the Exodus is or even when the time of the Exodus occurred. That bothers me because even if you just look amongst evangelicals, there's a 200-year swing in where people place the Exodus. Gee.
Yeah.
You know, and that just bugged the life. It was always something that bothered me. And so, I don't know, almost 20 years ago, I decided to really focus on that for a while and do a deep dive into it and see what happened. Of course, what happened was, is why I wrote the book. I mean, if I'd have taken the traditional early date for the Exodus, I didn't need to write the book. If I'd have taken the late Ramesside date for the Exodus, I wouldn't need to write that one either because there's plenty of stuff on both of those views. But I came up with something that I couldn't find anybody who really suggested this. And what it focused on was the fact that if the Exodus events actually happened as the Bible describes them, then what would have happened to Egypt? What historically socially, economically, what would have been the impact on ancient Egypt? And that became the focus of that study. So I've kind of bumped into a few things along the way like that besides what we're doing at Tal Hammam.
Right. And a lot of what you're doing, you do look at biblical chronology. So let's, can we talk for just a moment about the two views of the Exodus in general terms? I think the two main views are an 18th Egyptian dynasty and a 19th Egyptian dynasty, somewhere in the 15th
correct.
Century versus somewhere in the 13th century. Is that pretty much the gist of it?
That's correct. And they both come out of a view of how you treat key number sets in the Bible, whether you look at the Masoretic text, whether you tend toward looking at the numbers preserved in the Septuagint version. And what they're basically doing is crunching numbers on both of those views. They're crunching numbers from 1 Kings 6:1. And of course, 1 Kings 6:1 tells us that the Exodus occurred 480 years before Solomon began to build the temple in the fourth year of his reign, which is about 966. And if you add 480 to that, you get 1446. And that's the early date for the Exodus. I always call that the traditional early date. And then, of course, people like Albright, W.F. Albright, and a lot of other scholars, too, come along and they look at that 480-year statement from the Masoretic text, and they say, well, that's not a literal number by any means. It's an honorific number which just simply designates generations. These are 12 generations, generation being 40 years. 12 times 40 is 480. And that's an honorific generation, but since actual physical generations are only about 25 years, that would be 12 times 25, about, and that's about 300 years. And if you then go back 300 years from the time of King Solomon, you wind up in the reign of Ramesses the Great, sometime in the middle of the 13th century BC. So that gives us that traditional late view for the Exodus. They're number crunching. Everybody's number crunching from trying to get a literal absolute date.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we feel comfortable if we can put something on a page or into a folder.
Right.
And so we're doing that no matter whether you're an early date or a late date Exodus proponent, you're putting things into boxes so that you can look at them. That's comforting to us. But you take a little bit of a different view, don't you?
Yes, I did. I feel that most of the numbers in the Torah, in fact, I'd say all the Torah lifespan numbers, and so many of the numbers are, they're honorific formulas, and they don't use numbers like we use numbers in the modern world. As a result of that, you can wind up with vast differences in how you think about the historical chronological placement of biblical events. And of course, the Exodus is a big one. I mean, everything is a watershed off that. In the Old Testament and in the New Testament. I thought, why can't we get our heads together on this? And so I came up with a question that I couldn't find anybody asking. I looked at everybody who had written on the Pharaoh of the Exodus and the date of the Exodus, and I came up with a question that they seemed never to answer or even to ask, and I thought it was the one that ought to be asked. And it's this question: if all of those terrible events surrounding the Exodus actually happened to Egypt, all of those plagues and plunderings and loss of army and loss of economics and so many terrible things, if all of those things really happened to Egypt, what would be the result of that for Egypt? And the answer to that is it would be you'd predict a dynastic collapse. You'd predict that Egypt would be suffering in such a bad way that it would not be able to sustain itself as it had previously. And as I look at the early date for the Exodus, say under Thutmose III or Amenhotep II, or I look at a late date for the Exodus under, I always say under Yul Brynner.
Yes.
or Ramesses the Great,
yeah.
If people follow the movie. If you look at that, under none of those pharaohs that have ever been proposed for the Exodus, was there anything close to a collapse
sure.
of Egypt.
Yeah, these were
and,
big guys who did big things.
Yeah, they did great things, but during or toward the end of their reigns, there was nothing even remotely resembling a dynastic collapse. I got to thinking, well, if all of those terrible things really happened, then Egypt ought to be suffering terribly. So I went looking for that. And I thought, you know what? If somewhere in that 200-year time span where people have suggested the Exodus would reside, is there a dynastic, is there a collapse that would be commensurate with the terrible things that happened to Egypt in the book of Exodus? And I found it. It was so glaring to me that I wondered how in the world people hadn't seen it. I mean, everybody sees it, but they don't connect it. That was the fact that the great 18th dynasty rode high and large and powerful all through the 16th century and down into the 15th century and even down into the beginning of the 14th century. Great pharaohs like Thutmose III, Amenhotep II, and then he had a little son named Thutmose IV. Yes. And it's interesting that upon the death of Thutmose IV, Egypt went into a collapse and decline, a decline and collapse, I guess we'd say it that way.
So we have what most early date proponents would say is Amenhotep II, but you're proposing his son, Thutmose IV.
Yes.
Okay. So what was the situation in both Egypt and Israel at the time of the reign of Thutmose IV?
Well, for about 100 years prior to Thutmose IV, and he, of course, was a part of this as well, the entirety of the southern Levant, and we'd say, you know, what today is Israel, Lebanon, Syria, was under what we call the Egyptian domination. Egypt dominated that region. They had actually extended their borders all the way to the Euphrates River, and they had done so early on in a military manner, and they had, under Thutmose IV, solidified that with an international treaty made with the king of Mitanni, and that's located in the northern central part of Mesopotamia. And with the solidification of the Egypto, what I call the Egypto-Mitannian alliance, that solidified all of that territory under the really an iron-fisted control of Egypt. So Egypt was controlling everything in Canaan and Syria. When Thutmose IV died, that stopped. And you have to take a look at that.
Okay, you may have the answer to my question here. The minimalist archaeologist, Dr. Israel Finkelstein, he makes the claim that the Bible knows nothing of Egypt in the land. If Egypt is controlling Canaan, when the Israelites come in, he says, no, the Bible doesn't know anything about that. Is he correct on that?
Well, no. Actually, I mean, history tells us marvelously that this was the case. Egypt was controlling the Levant. What was Israel doing at this time? Well, Israel was mostly parked down there in Egypt, in the Delta region of Egypt, and in slavery and bondage. And what's interesting about that is that the 18th dynasty was noted for its systematic capture and enslavement of Semitic people from the Levant.
Right.
And, of course, Jacob and his family under Joseph had gone down there willingly. But there came a pharaoh, and I think that's the first pharaoh of the 18th dynasty, the pharaoh that did not know Joseph. A pharaoh arose, and we know that Akhmose the first, and right. Then all the subsequent pharaohs of the 18th dynasty are heavily anti-Semitic. They actually were the ones that enslaved and put in bondage not only the Israelites who were in Egypt at the time, but also continued to raid Canaan for additional slaves.
Right, and now that
and
ties
so that,
in.
That sets up. That's a perfect match for the for all of the bondage narratives in the Torah.
And you're right. And this is again, we have other numbers that people looking at different texts are going to argue with here, and that's the length of the sojourn. We've got about 5.5 minutes left on today's program. Could you speak a little bit about on your views of how long the Israelites were in the land and who was in control at the time of Joseph and why Ahmose may be the pharaoh who did not know him?
Yes. The traditional view of that is from Exodus 12:40. Which is to say that in that particular scripture, it says that they were in Egypt 430 years. That is the Israelites.
Right. That seems straightforward.
But if you look at the Septuagint and you look at, well, both versions of the Septuagint, and virtually every other line of evidence, Josephus, Demetrius, the Greek chronographer, even the Apostle Paul in Galatians 3, confirmed that they were actually in Egypt only half of that time, about 215 years, that this 430-year number was the time of the sojourn of the patriarchs, including Abraham, and the Israelites who went down into Egypt. And so, as Paul says very, very clearly in Galatians 3, from the giving of the promise to Abraham, that's Genesis 12, to the coming of the law, that's Sinai, was 430 years. And so, it's the time from Jacob to the time of the Exodus is about 200 or so years, maybe a little less. And so, that's what the Septuagint confirms. Both versions of it, and just about every other line of evidence that you can look at confirms what we call a short sojourn of the Israelites in Egypt. The only piece, scrap of evidence, and it really isn't much, for the long sojourn of 430 years comes from the Masoretic text from Exodus 12:40.
Wow. So it's one thing to shift the date of the Exodus about 40 years, depending on your text. That doesn't really change a whole lot. But if we say, we do a 215-year shift, that changes our view on when exactly these things took place, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The patriarchal period, of course, the placement of the patriarchal period is crucial here. People have to understand that Abraham doesn't belong as early as the early date Exodus would give us. Because if you put that 430 years in place for the sojourn of Israel in Egypt, it pushes Abraham and most of the patriarchs back so early that cities like Jerusalem and virtually all the cities and towns mentioned in the patriarchal narratives are not even occupied. For example, Jerusalem is completely unoccupied from about 2500 BC down to about 1800 BC. And so to put Abraham before 1800 BC, you don't have a single town, not even Jerusalem, that are mentioned in the story of his story and the other narratives.
Right. And traditionally, you will hear Bible-believing evangelical scholars would put Abraham around, around the year 2000, right? About 4,000 years ago.
Even before that, they'd put him the birth in 2166. Problem with that is, as I just mentioned, it's the completely wrong cultural placement and socio-political placement for Abraham, because nothing that the Bible describes in the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob exists prior to 1800 BC.
Well, with the last minute and a half or so in the program, can you tell us a little bit about synchronisms? Because you're touching on that here with Abraham and the cultural experience.
When I wanted to find the time of the Exodus, the moment of the Exodus and the Pharaoh of the Exodus, I gave up the number crunching idea and said, well, the best way to find it would be to use what I call cultural synchronisms. That is to look at key things that only exist in certain periods of time in the Bible and in the ancient Near Eastern history and archaeology, and find a way that those click together, and to find a way that the biblical history and the ancient Near Eastern history dance with each other, they synchronize with each other, that the events that are described become in both cases, become an organic cause and effect relationship between the Bible and the Near East history. And when I did that, the location of the Exodus in time and the identification of the Pharaoh of the Exodus, just big, huge spotlight went on. And it lit up, and it was so clear to me, I haven't been able to refute myself to this point.
Well, I'm excited. We're going to look at that in tomorrow's program. We're going to get into actually locating these things in history. So thank you for listening to Watchmen on the Wall. I am your host today, Clayton Van Hus. We've been talking with Dr. Stephen Collins, who is the author of Let My People Go, where he uses historical synchronisms to identify the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Dr. Collins, thank you. We look forward to chatting tomorrow.
Appreciate it, Clayton. Thank you.
Dr. Stephen Collins continues his look at the Exodus and the identity of the Pharaoh of the Exodus on our next program. You can read all about Dr. Collins' search for the identity of the Pharaoh of the Exodus in his excellent book entitled, Let My People Go. Historians and Bible scholars have a long history of speculation about the identity of the Pharaoh at the time of the Israelite exodus from Egypt. Indeed, we cannot help but wonder to which of Egypt's great kings Moses said, "Let my people go." Dr. Stephen Collins' detailed study reveals that the Exodus events as described in the Bible do in fact fit with precision into a corresponding segment of ancient Near Eastern history, when sources from Egypt, around the world, and the biblical narratives are properly understood and superimposed. Let My People Go is a book that will fascinate, inform, and ultimately affirm the truth of Scripture. Order Let My People Go today when you call 1-800-652-1144. That's 1-800-652-1144. You can also order online, swrc.com. Let My People Go by Dr. Stephen Collins, 1-800-652-1144. The world is changing so fast. With economic uncertainty, war in the Middle East and Ukraine, there's a need to keep the Scriptures in front of our hearts and minds. How do the events on the news relate to the end times? Well, let's find out. Here are Dr. Larry Spargimino and Marvin McIlvaney with today's headlines from the End Times Report.
Well, Marvin, I think Armageddon has been postponed for a while. I'm referring to Israel's answer to the Iranian attack on Saturday when Tehran sent a volley of more than 300 drones and missiles toward targets in Israel. I thought maybe Israel would do to Iran what they did to Gaza. Israel turned Gaza into a burning pile of rubble. That would have started a bigger regional war.
I agree, Pastor Larry. I'm not sure if the average American realizes how close we are to an all-out nuclear war. The response from the Israelis seems to be mild compared to what the Iranians did. Only 3 missiles were fired from an Israeli fighter jet in Friday morning's very limited strike. The Israelis were targeting an air defense radar site that's part of the protection for their nuclear facility. The first evaluation is that the strike took out the site.
Well, the strike was intended to send a signal to Iran that Israel has these capabilities, but was not looking to escalate the situation, according to an Israeli official. So once again, Marvin, Israel has shown great patience by not leveling Iran's nuclear site. But today, you know, Tehran warned it has the ability to strike Israeli nuclear sites if Israel targets Iran's nuclear facilities. You know, Marvin, these people are crazy.
Absolutely.
I mean, let's face it. You know, how can you live with this hostility against an ethnic group? And you got missiles, and you got bombs, and you got all this stuff. These people, no, they're not crazy. They're demon-possessed.
Amen.
Because they have a religion that tends in that direction. Now, not all of them are that way. I know some are really good. But this guy, I mean, these leaders, are they human or are they demons? But let's continue.
Well, personally, I don't think Iran has the capability to fly into Israel and do any damage. I don't think anyone else thinks that Iran can win a war with Israel. But that's not to say maybe China or Russia has given Iran a nuclear-tipped missile. Israel's military displayed what they say is an Iranian ballistic missile that they retrieved from the Dead Sea. If they start launching those things, then hang on, because who knows what will follow.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council on Thursday, Iran now threatens to target Israeli nuclear facilities. The Middle East is on the precipice of a broader war. One miscalculation, one miscommunication, one mistake could lead to the unthinkable, a full-scale regional conflict that would be devastating for all involved and for the rest of the world.
I don't like the sound of that, Pastor Larry, but the United States is also in deep trouble. Our southern border is wide open. They are arresting known terrorists. These people are on the terrorist watch list at our border. This is insane. The Republicans in Congress were holding Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas responsible.
It's interesting. You know, Congress voted to impeach him for not doing his job. You would think if your title is Homeland Security, you would make our homeland secure. But the Senate, led by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, simply said the charges are unconstitutional. The articles of impeachment brought by the House charge Mayorkas with willfully and systematically refusing to comply with federal immigration laws and having breached the public trust by making false statements to Congress, such as claiming the border is secure.
I don't think anyone really believes the border is secure. Senator Marco Rubio said recently, quote, "This invasion of the United States is going to get worse. We are consistently ignoring the needs of everyday, hardworking Americans and putting something or someone else above them over and over and over again. That's why people lose faith in their institutions," close quotes.
Martin, the Mayorkas situation is a farce. I mean, let's face it. This man, along with our president, exposed Americans to all kinds of terrible people who may be sick, who they may have Ebola. Come on now. They may have a suitcase nuke. They may have chemical weapons or some juice that they're going to put in a reservoir. And this is unconstitutional. Give me a break. What's wrong with us? We don't punish evil. That's why we don't trust the government. The government punishes us. Hardworking American citizens who have paid taxes. Some of us have had our ancestors here that we've built cities, we've built towns, we've worked so hard. We've sacrificed, yes, we've built churches. And they disregard us like we're bad people. Can you imagine? And these people come over and they get all these privileges. This man is a criminal. How can these people get away with that? I don't understand it.
Let My People Go by Dr. Stephen Collins is a book that will fascinate, inform, and ultimately affirm the truth of Scripture. Historians and Bible scholars have a long history of speculation about the true identity of the Pharaoh at the time of the Israelite exodus from Egypt. This book examines the evidence and presents the reality of who the Pharaoh was during the time of the exodus. Order Let My People Go when you call 1-800-652-1144. That's 1-800-652-1144. You can also order online, swrc.com. Let My People Go by Dr. Stephen Collins. 1-800-652-1144. Tomorrow, Dr. Stephen Collins will continue sharing the results from his study on the true identity of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Be sure to tune in on your favorite radio station or by visiting pray.com. Watchmen on the Wall is a production of Southwest Radio Ministries and has been supported for 91 years by faithful listeners like you. Visit swrc.com.